Welcome to NPR News Presents, Today in Election Eve Special. Hi, I'm Gary Eichten, and after one of the most unusual election campaigns in American history, voters are finally going to make their choice. Who will be the next president? Who will control the Congress? Who will control the legislature? And who will decide how much those legislators should get paid? This hour we'll have more on all those issues. We'll get started right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. With national polls revealing his Democratic rival has an edge over him, Donald Trump is barnstorming those states where he believes undecided voters could swing the numbers his way. That's been glaringly evident in Florida. At stake are 29 electoral votes. Florida is a toss-up, and Trump likely needs it. The GOP nominee was in Sarasota this afternoon, where he pressed a message that has been resonating strongly with his base.
The system is rigged. At least we know it. And people in this country, I think because of us, have never known it so obviously as they do now. The system is totally rigged.
Polls show Hillary Clinton still leading in Pennsylvania, but by narrower margins than a few weeks ago. In Pittsburgh this hour, the Democrats sought to make a strong pitch for why she thinks she's the only real choice for president.
The choice in this election could not be clearer. It really is between division or unity, between strong and steady leadership or a loose cannon, between an economy that works for everyone, not just those at the top, and an economy that is set up and run for those at the top.
Clinton has also been focusing on turning out African-American voters whose share in early voting numbers declined. That's one key reason why Clinton had focused more on turning out the vote in Philadelphia and Detroit in recent days. Janet Reno, the first woman to serve as U.S. Attorney General, has died. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports Reno passed away from complications related to Parkinson's disease.
Janet Reno's death at age 78 closes a rich chapter at the Justice Department. Her tenure spanned several controversies, from the siege on a compound in Waco, Texas, to the fight over special prosecutors investigating Bill Clinton's cabinet members. Reno also presided over the successful prosecutions of the Oklahoma City bomber and the Unabomber. Despite her clashes with Congress and the White House, Reno's remembered in Washington with affection for the way she stood up to critics and faced the heat. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
We turn now to Iraq, where security forces are conducting clearing operations in villages north and south of the city of Mosul. NPR's Alice Fortin reports the villages were held by ISIS.
North of the city in the village of Bashika, Iraqi Kurdish soldiers known as Peshmerga launched an operation this morning. Peshmerga commanders tell NPR ISIS have responded with car bombs, but they are making progress with air support from the US-led coalition. Meanwhile, fighting is intense in the eastern part of the city of Mosul itself. An eyewitness inside says ISIS is preventing people from leaving and mosques are broadcasting calls for people to join the fighting. Alice Fordham, NPR News, Erbil, Northern Iraq.
You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Novo Nordisk, which is committed to a healthy economy, environment, and society as part of everything it does. Learn more about their commitment at novonordisk.us.
For Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Stephen John. The record pace of early voting continues with more than 500,000 Minnesotans already casting ballots. That update today from the Secretary of State's office. 2016 marks the first presidential campaign where voters don't have to state a reason in order to vote absentee. With one day to go until the election, Democrats are traveling Minnesota to rally volunteers and voters. Catherine Richard reports.
Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, Senator Amy Klobuchar, and 1st District Congressman Tim Walz spoke to a packed Rochester DFL headquarters Monday morning. Walz said volunteers need to focus on getting people to the polls.
All of the stuff out there that was out of our control, from FBI to media, whatever it was, we can't control any of that. We can control our vote. We can control the people we go talk to get their vote to the poll. Let's not rest. Let's get out. These are close elections that are won in the next 35 hours. So let's go get them.
Volunteers here will be door knocking and making calls in earnest over the next 24 hours, hoping an organized ground game will give Democratic candidates an edge. That includes presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Democratic leaders say Donald Trump's visit to the Twin Cities on Sunday energized the DFL base. Catherine Richard, Minnesota Public Radio News in Rochester.
A man's defamation trial against a pair of Minnesota media outlets begins today. 38-year-old Ryan Larson alleges Care TV and the St. Cloud Times damaged his reputation when they published statements implicating him in the killing of Cold Spring police officer Thomas Decker in 2012. The news organizations say their reporting is protected because it was based on public information provided by law enforcement. Sky's mostly cloudy today for Minnesota. Some showers possible, central and south. 61 currently in the Twin Cities. It's 12:06.
Programming supported by TKDA, an employee-owned engineering, architecture, and planning firm, building long-standing client relationships through competence, integrity, and diversity in market, staff, and ideas. Projects and career opportunities at tkda.com.
Welcome to a special Election Eve edition of NPR News Presents with political editor Mike Mulcahy. I'm Gary Eichten, and today we're getting ready for tomorrow, Election Day. No doubt about it, there's lots to talk about this hour. This has been one of the most tumultuous presidential election campaigns in U.S. history. And here in Minnesota, we have not one, not two, but three unusually competitive congressional races. Control of both houses of the Minnesota legislature will be decided tomorrow. There's a constitutional amendment on the ballot. And, of course, all those local races on your ballot as well. So thank you so much for joining us. Senator Amy Klobuchar and Congressman Tom Emmer will be along shortly. Secretary of State Steve Simon will join us, and we'll hear from political reporters Bax, Pugmire, and Zdechlik, and have expert analysis from Catherine Pearson, Todd Rapp, and Maureen Shaver. But, Mike, a wild and woolly ride to get to this point.
Gary, I think the key word is surprise. I think some people, even in this room maybe, would have been surprised 15 months ago if we would have said Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee. I think people would have been surprised Hillary Clinton had such a tough race against Bernie Sanders. That videotape of Trump that came out, the emails, the FBI last week weighing in on that, yesterday saying never mind, Donald Trump campaigning in Minnesota the Sunday before the election. Yeah, it's been surprising.
Maureen Shaver is our Republican analyst, Todd Rapp, our Democratic analyst. Maureen, did you ever imagine we would have gone where we have gone in this campaign, heard the things we've heard?
No, Gary, I don't believe we had. I did not feel that way. But I also think we can't be surprised by campaigns anymore. Technology, how we're reaching out to voters, all of those things have made it the opportunity for things to be a little more complicated.
Todd?
This is the first campaign I can remember when there was never really positive momentum after a week or two after the conventions. It's all been about negative momentum. It's all been about whoever's in the news is the candidate who loses ground. And yes, that's pretty surprising to me.
Todd, setting aside the presidential race, which ones do you find most interesting?
The three congressional seats. They really mirror the different scenarios that the Democrats have for either reducing or maybe taking over power in Congress.
Maureen?
I agree, except I think those congressional races are going to have a big impact on who shows up and how people vote in the legislature. And we in Minnesota have some big decisions to make tomorrow about who will be in control of the Minnesota Senate and the Minnesota House.
Will this election campaign, as it's played out, is this what we have for the future? Is this what we can expect every election going forward, except maybe even a little more extreme? Maureen?
I think it depends on what happens tomorrow. Things will be rewarded the way people campaigns will be rewarded. But Gary, I do think we are at a unique place in time. And I think these were two very unique candidates. And I actually see people coming up in both parties behind them that will be very different if they run for president.
Todd?
This is how it's going to be for at least 4 years, because one of these two is going to run for re-election in 2020. But we've been through periods like this. 1968 was incredibly tumultuous. And eventually, we got back to a position where I think campaigns elevated themselves to a different level. It's just with social media and the breadth of cable news, there's just a lot more different ways that you can influence an election than we used to have.
Mike, Todd, Maureen will be on the air tomorrow night with co-host Tom Cran for NPR's live election night coverage. Our coverage begins at 7 tomorrow night. And a quick reminder, by the way, when you vote tomorrow, if you haven't voted already, NPR News wants to hear about your voting experience. Go to nprnews.org/election to sign up, and then we'll check in with you on Election Day. course, Donald Trump has been warning that this election is rigged. Security experts have been warning that the election might get hacked. So to get us started this hour, shed some light on those issues, Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. Secretary Simon, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Is there any evidence that this election is rigged?
I need to be crystal clear. In Minnesota, the election will not be rigged, period. It would be such an amazing undertaking for someone to attempt to do something like that. We have a decentralized system, not just across 87 counties, but across 3,500 plus polling places. We still vote pen to paper. We still vote on paper, and it's very hard to hack paper from a technological standpoint. And so everything about our system is designed to put no one person in control. For someone to try to fix or rig an election in Minnesota, it would mean getting to hundreds, if not thousands, of people as part of this scheme. It's not going to happen. We are well prepared. We have a good history of clean elections in this state, and I just want to put people's fears to rest along those lines.
Is there any question that a person who casts a vote will, that vote will be counted, will it not?
Yes, absolutely. And that includes both votes that are cast tomorrow on Election Day and all the votes that are cast by absentee before that, including today. That includes people who vote in person absentee and people who voted by mail absentee. Every ballot counts equally, including absentee ballots. And that's just the way it goes. And, you know, we keep ballots, keep in mind, for nearly 2 years under state law. The actual paper ballots have to be kept. So if anyone alleges, for example, back to sort of the hacking thing or rigging, if someone alleges that Russia or China or the guy next door added a zero or subtracted a zero from someone's vote total, we're going to figure that out. We've got the paper. We've got the sort of native source. And that's what puts us ahead of many other states.
Now, I wanted to ask you about plans, or at least announced plans. Trump campaign said it was going to make a concerted effort to monitor the election. Here in Minnesota, what does that mean? How many observers are actually allowed inside election sites?
I'm glad you asked that, because in Minnesota, we have real rules and sort of guardrails around that process. In Minnesota, each political party is entitled to send one person, not 10, not 20, just one, to a polling place to be a sort of poll observer or someone that can make a challenge to someone's eligibility. But even then, those challenges have to be made based on personal knowledge. It can't be a hunch. It can't be a whim. It can't be because you don't like the looks of someone. It's got to be based on personal knowledge. Anyone else who's not part of that process, who doesn't have a challenge based on personal knowledge, they can stand, like everyone else, 100 feet away from the polling place. That's the rule in Minnesota. So we're not going to have and can't have sort of an invasion of the polling places by self-appointed or other folks who just want to kind of watch and try to disqualify people.
A couple of other quick questions for you, Secretary Simon. If you've already voted, can you change your mind?
At this point, you can't. Until last Tuesday at the close of business, you could have. We have a rule in Minnesota because the absentee ballots don't start being processed until 1 week before the election or close of business on Tuesday, really. Technically, up until that point, people could have sort of fished their ballot out of the pile. But now that that period has passed, nope, you're stuck with it. And if you voted by absentee, you cannot change your vote.
Can you take a selfie in the election booth area?
Yeah, Minnesota has no law prohibiting selfies. There are a couple states that have had that, and the courts have kind of chastised them recently on First Amendment grounds. But no, we have no such limitation on selfies. Other than that, you can't show a copy of either your selfie or your actual completed ballot to anyone in the polling place, and you can't take a picture of some other voter in the polling place as well. But as long as it's just the voter and just their ballot, that is allowed under Minnesota law, although we really ask people in the polling place to be respectful. People seeing others taking pictures, even if it's just of themselves in the polling place, tend to be a little unsettled by that, and that's a reasonable feeling. And so we just ask people to be respectful and show some restraint.
And just one quick question. 568,000 people have already voted. If you've already voted and you go to your polling place, will the election judge know you've already voted and stop you?
Yes. There is a notation on the roster that says simply AB or absentee ballot. So that is a challenge to the person's eligibility to vote. Again, that system has served us very well over decades. And by the way, I just have to say that number, 568,000, it is off the charts. Just so your listeners know, and maybe you've already discussed this before I got on, but that is more than triple where we were 4 years ago. So it's an amazing rate of early voting or voting before Election Day by absentee. And I think that is mostly due to the fact that we have a new law on the books since 4 years ago, allowing any of us to vote without an excuse by absentee. We no longer need a reason to vote, such as illness or being out of town.
Secretary Steve Simon, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Obviously, the presidential contest is the main event this year, and joining us now is one of Hillary Clinton's key Minnesota supporters, Senator Amy Klobuchar. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Gary. I enjoyed that discussion. I thought you were getting so in the weeds on the voting rules, like maybe you would ask if you could bring in your Gary Aitken bobblehead and take a selfie with the bobblehead, and if that was allowed.
I understand.
There's a lot of questions there.
I understand the bobblehead can vote.
I don't think Steve Simon would allow that, although I will say I hope that detailed discussion makes everyone know that our elections in Minnesota are good, clean, and not rigged.
So what is the most important reason that you're supporting Secretary Clinton rather than Donald Trump?
Well, for me, it's because I want a strong commander-in-chief. It has really concerned me, some of his behavior during this election, whether it's the late-night tweet storms or whether it is talking about adding nuclear weapons to countries in Asia that didn't have them before, or questioning our NATO alliance at a time when Russia has been found to have sponsored the terrorism that brought the plane down in Ukraine and been engaged in cyber attacks, posing up to Putin. And I just see her broad experience and her grace under pressure as something that you want to see in a commander-in-chief. And I'd say the other thing is what I observed yesterday when he came to town and literally took a broad brush and went after our Somali community. A community that is part of the fabric of life in Minnesota. This isn't to say that we don't go after every security concern when they happen, that we're not proud of the work the U.S. Attorney's Office and agents have done in going after people who are going to join ISIS. But that aside, we also know that the vast majority of our Somali community is law-abiding, important part of our economy, and we're proud to have them in our state. And it's just that kind of behavior that makes you think, how can we go forward as a country, as a unified country in a global economy, if we would continue to hear this rhetoric every single day he lands his plane on the ground? And I think it's important we move on to a better time here.
Well, Senator, if Donald Trump would win, can you wholeheartedly support him as president of the United States?
I will work with anyone who becomes our president. I have always said that in every election. And I think the problem is, as President Obama pointed out, you look at the past Republican candidates, John McCain, who's a very close friend of mine, or Mitt Romney, they passed a certain test of being a commander-in-chief, and we just haven't seen this with Donald Trump.
Do you think this campaign has set a new standard for how campaigns will be conducted in the future, or is this a one-off operation?
I hope not. I think we respect some civility in our state, and what has really bothered me about, first of all, is the outside money, and I think that's a big part of the problem, because then candidates no longer have control of the message. You see this in the House races in Minnesota, and all this outside money is a result of Citizens United. I would love to see either a constitutional amendment, which I support, to change that, or reversal by the court. But we have to have a change. The second is, of course, the rhetoric. And my hope is that tomorrow we see a major rejection of the kind of campaign that Trump has been running, the fact that it's so hard to tell the difference between what's true and what's not, and that we can then, because there are still Republicans in Congress that I know that want to work constructively to get things done, that we are able to do that.
Thank you very much, Senator. Appreciate it.
It's good to be on. Thank you so much, Gary. Have a great day, and we look forward to talking to you on that late night tomorrow night.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar joining us. Unlike some other Republicans, Minnesota's 6th District Congressman Tom Emmer has not jumped ship Congressman Emmer is still supporting Donald Trump, and he joins us now. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Why is Donald Trump a better candidate than a better choice for president than Secretary Clinton?
Great question that I know we're all going to be answering finally tomorrow when the polls close. For me, though, Gary, I know what Hillary Clinton will offer us in the presidency. And while I may not know everything that a Donald Trump will, I think we have a better opportunity to change things with different leadership than a leader who's basically proposing continuing policies or, frankly, building upon policies that have put this country in a place where, one, economically, we just are not growing the way we need to grow. You know, 1.7% roughly annual GDP growth since 2008 and 1.1% GDP growth in the last three quarters. That's not going to do it. She is talking about spending all kinds of new money. We're going to be $20 trillion in debt, Gary. When President Obama came to office, we were $10 trillion in debt. He managed to double that in 8 years. Now we've got someone who's proposing to do the same policies, build off the same policies that are just, frankly, have us running up the down escalator with our economy. And then the other big one for me, Gary, I looked at the candidate being offered by the Democrats, Hillary Clinton. She has her fingerprints all over the foreign policy that we have, if you can call it that, that we have had as a country over the last 8 years. And I think to a person, and this is not a Republican thing, this is not a Democrat thing, this is an American thing. To a person, I think we can honestly say when we're asked, do you feel safer today than you did 8 years ago? The answer is no. The world has become a much more dangerous place because this lead from behind, incremental, reactionary foreign policy that doesn't seem to have any articulated purpose or strategy, frankly, has allowed things to devolve. Perhaps not as bad, or we haven't seen it this bad since maybe the 30s or around World War II. So that's why I look at it. The policies that have not been working, you look at Obamacare, for instance. What she thinks Obamacare is a good start. Minnesotans, I can guarantee you, do not believe, especially the 150,000 Minnesotans, and specifically Minnesotans from Stearns County and Benton County, which I represent, who have lost their policy or will lose their policy at the end of the year and don't have a policy to get. I am seeing this 60 to 67% rate hike. This isn't in a vacuum, Gary. This, you know, I got a call from a guy who's a single breadwinner, family of four, two young kids. He had a 25% increase last year, a 50% increase this year. He's being told his premium will be $18,500 next year. So these are the things that a Hillary Clinton presidency offers us in the future. I don't think that's the right way to go.
Congressman, a quick question for you. If Secretary Clinton does win, can you wholeheartedly support her, given all these reservations?
I would phrase it a little differently. I can work with the administration. We've been able to work with the Obama administration on things like Cuba, for instance, Gary. There's always a way to work with somebody, even if they have different political views, I believe, because at the end of the day, we all essentially want the same things. We want an economy that is growing and actually is available for everyone to reach their full potential. And we want to feel safe and secure in our communities and our homes. So at the end of the day, we want the same things. We just have different ways of getting there. And regardless of who is in that office, Gary, Congress is going to have to find a way to work with them to get the important things the American people expect to get done.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you, Gary.
Minnesota 6th District Republican Congressman Tom Emmer. Now, Mike, we should note, actually, there are more than two presidential candidates on the ballot.
Absolutely. There are nine total, and some you may have heard of and some you may not have. The Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, Independence Party candidate, Evan McMullen. And it's important for those parties because if they can get 5% in the presidential race, they could be a major party next time out. There's also the Legalized Marijuana Party Now candidate, the Constitution Party, the Socialist Workers. So there are some choices.
Todd, Maureen, given the nature of the campaign, the harshness of the rhetoric and so on, are you expecting that when all is said and done, this will spike turnout tomorrow, or will it depress turnout? Todd?
Well, first of all, we didn't just hear really negative campaigning from either Senator Klobuchar or Congressman Emmer. They gave very articulate cases. I think it's likely to depress turnout in some places, and I note that the Clinton campaign has been worried about African-American turnout specifically. I think in Minnesota, though, early voting is probably helping mitigate whatever depressed turnout there would be. And maybe a few weeks ago, I would have been surprised to say this, but we still may hit 3 million votes in this state, which is probably where we should be in 2016 because of the great success of early voting.
Maureen?
I think we saw a great deal of enthusiasm, especially for Democrats in 2008 and 2012 with President Obama, and we did in 2004 when George W. Bush ran for re-election. So enthusiasm really does drive turnout. I'll be very curious. We're going to look pretty carefully the day after this election at what the college campuses are doing. I think that Democrats need to be worried about the college and millennials getting out to vote. I think the negativity of this campaign will especially affect that voting bloc.
Maureen, do you think there's any chance that the Republicans will finally win a presidential race in Minnesota? It's been, what, 44 years?
I think Donald Trump coming to Minnesota yesterday had a little bit more about digging at Secretary Clinton and, frankly, getting the Western Wisconsin media market than it did anything else. So I guess I would be hard-pressed to think this will be the year we break through, because primarily the turnout effort on Secretary Clinton is just much more robust than it is for Donald Trump. And frankly, that's around the country. They have taken two very different strategies about how to get voters to the polls. And I think in Minnesota, that's going to help Secretary Clinton.
Todd?
I think this was one of the few states where Donald Trump wasn't able to finish in the top two in the caucus or the primary. I think that showed something about enthusiasm. And with almost 600,000 people already having voted, if Donald Trump wanted to win this state, he's about 3 weeks late in being here.
Do you, Todd, see any overwhelming issue in the presidential campaign, or is it purely about the personalities of the candidates?
I think health care has emerged, specifically health care costs have emerged. But no, I think the personality traits of the candidates, the trust you have in them, and whether or not you think they'll be a good leader on the world stage, those are way more important factors than any one issue.
Maureen?
I agree that health care is probably come in late as a defining issue between the two parties, and frankly will have more of an impact on the legislative races. But I think Congressman Emmer kind of got to the essence of a Minnesotan who is supporting Donald Trump. They do not feel that they have been part of the success of the economy moving forward. They do feel left behind. I think that's why we're seeing it in certain pockets of our state that Donald Trump is doing well and frankly going to help in some of these congressional districts.
Last question in this segment for the two of you. If Donald Trump, as he's threatened, if he doesn't accept the results of the election, assuming he loses, what then? Maureen?
I think we're going to have, on Wednesday, we're going to have overwhelming understanding of who our next president is. And people who lose, Democrats or Republicans, they talk bigger before the election than afterwards. And I don't think we'll have a constitutional crisis in this country.
Todd?
Well, I would agree with Maureen. And frankly, he doesn't have many choices after Thursday or Friday of this week other than to become a national political commentator. Because there's not the Constitution doesn't require him to concede in order for us to have a new president take office on January 20th.
Todd Rapp, who is a Democrat. Maureen Shaver is our Republican analyst. And also joining us, Catherine Pearson, who teaches political science at the University of Minnesota. Used to work for both Republicans and Democrats in the Congress. And, of course, besides electing a president tomorrow, we also are electing a Congress to work with the next president. Right now, Republicans control both houses of the Congress, fairly narrow margin in the Senate, fairly comfortable margin in the House. And, Professor, based on what you've been hearing, what are the prospects nationwide?
Well, if you look at the House of Representatives, of course, all 435 seats are open, with members running for re-election and open seats. But fewer than a tenth of those races are actually competitive. And in order to take majority party control, Democrats would need to pick up 30 seats. And some of those are easy targets, competitive races where Obama won in 2012 but are held by a Republican. But the vast majority of them would actually be pretty difficult. And so I think it's likely that Democrats will pick up seats in the House of Representatives. I don't think it's likely that they'll get really anywhere near the 30 that they would need. The Senate, on the other hand, the U.S. Senate, is too close to call. Democrats would need 5 seats in order to get to 51, so a simple majority. But Democrats do have some structural advantages. 34 U.S. Senate seats are open, 24 of which are being defended by Republicans. And of the 8 most competitive seats, 2 are already leaning from Republican hands toward Democrats. That's Illinois and Wisconsin, although they're still competitive. And of the 6 races that are ranked as toss-up races, only 1, Nevada, is currently held by a Democrat. Of course, it's an open seat with Harry Reid's retirement. So it's anyone's guess as to what will happen in the U.S. Senate, but I think in part it will depend on what happens in the presidential election.
Have there been any overriding issues across the country in these congressional races?
These congressional races have really been focused on the top of the ticket. In general, in recent years, split-ticket voting is down. And in this particular election, many Republicans in competitive seats, not so much in safe seats, but in competitive seats, are really deciding whether or not to distance themselves from Donald Trump. And so those have been big campaign issues, whether or not they've decided to stick with their party's nominee or distance themselves. Democrats have tried to really use that. On the other hand, Republicans are also, in some races, attacking Democrats for their support of Clinton and also the Affordable Care Act. But I think it's striking how much the top of the ticket has been an issue in congressional races. When we think of the adage, all politics is local, and many of these districts being so different.
Is that typical where the presidential race drives to this extent?
It has become increasingly common in recent years. We are a narrowly divided but highly polarized electorate where 9 out of 10 Republicans and 9 out of 10 Democrats typically vote for their party's candidate for president, and we've seen numbers approaching that in House and Senate elections. But I think this election in particular, the emphasis has really been on the top of the ticket in congressional races.
So no matter how these turn out, races for the U.S. House, races for the U.S. Senate. No matter how that turns out, can we expect gridlock to reign supreme?
Well, if we have divided government after Tuesday, which I think is likely, then yes, I think we will continue to see gridlock. Even though members on both sides of the aisle complain about not being able to get anything done, there are significant policy differences between the two parties. But much more important than that is the competition between the two parties, the lack of cooperation so that the other party can't make any gains. We typically see this leading into a presidential election cycle, but I'm really worried that we're going to see this from day one. Both candidates, Trump and Clinton, are so unpopular with members of the other party. I think it will be very difficult for either of them as president to get any support from the other party's members.
So as a political scientist, is that good or bad for the nation as a whole? I mean, you know, because...
Yeah.
It's a contested political system that we have.
I think in general, the separation of powers model is a good one. I think in an age of high polarization and competition between the parties, where each party views the other's success as their loss, it's very problematic. It used to be that there were major legislative successes, whether or not we were in periods of unified or divided party control. But if you look back to recent years, whether it's the Bush administration with unified government or the Obama administration, we really see the greatest productivity during times of unified party control rather than divided government. And I do think that's troubling because there are a lot of issues on which the parties should be able to work together that aren't necessarily inherently partisan in nature.
University of Minnesota political scientist Catherine Pearson. Now, truth be told, there are very few congressional races across the country that are very competitive. Usually one party or the other wins fairly easily. But, Mike, we actually have 3 here in Minnesota.
3 seats, Gary. The 2nd District, the 3rd District, and the 8th District. 2 of those are largely suburban areas. 1 is largely a rural area. In the 2nd District, just south and east of Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's been a hard-fought race between Democrat Angie Craig and Republican Jason Lewis. Brian Bax has been watching it for us, and he's here with us now. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Mike.
Republican John Klein has won this seat fairly easily since he was first elected in 2002. He decided not to run for re-election this year. Why do the Democrats think they have a good chance to pick this seat up?
Well, in large part because it's an open seat. These open seats are typically more receptive to kind of newcomers. And this is a race where neither candidate comes out of central casting. You know, you have Angie Craig, who comes from the business world. She doesn't have a long legislative voting record, so there's no stepping stone which can be used against her. And Jason Lewis isn't the type of candidate that John Klein was. He's not an establishment figure. He comes from kind of the firebrand wing of the party.
Talk radio.
So both sides feel like they've got candidates that they can work with. And, you know, with Jason Lewis, you know, he kind of mirrors Trump a little bit, but that's also been used against him in this race quite a bit.
So what have the big issues been so far?
Well, healthcare has been a major one because Angie Craig's background is in the medical device industry, so she's versed in the issue, but also the Republicans have tried to make it as though she's kind of a clouded in the Obamacare because the medical device tax was a central part of that and the just the affordability of some of these features of the healthcare act. So they've been using that quite a bit. And Jason Lewis has been an issue himself. His talk radio days, a lot of what he said over 25 years on the radio has come back in these ads. There have been a couple of other issues that have come up that have been interesting but haven't been able to poke through. Both of these candidates have talked a lot about opioid abuse and what the federal government could do to kind of crack down on that. Mm-hmm. And Jason Lewis has tried to make energy and the environment, kind of what regulatory policies, he's tried to make that an issue because there is a farm component to this district as well.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, with all the ads, people might not be paying any attention to that. And because it's a competitive district, it's drawn, like these districts do, a lot of outside money. How much money has come into the district?
Absolutely. This is a race where the outside spending came in kind of late, but it's come on heavy. It's about $7 million so far. The groups on both ends of this race have spent. And the candidates themselves, there's a wide gulf. Angie Craig, who gave her campaign quite a bit of money as seed in along the way, she spent about $3 million. Jason Lewis on his own has only spent about $700,000 through kind of the middle of October. Hmm. So without this outside group spending, it might not be as competitive as it is.
And we've been talking about the presidential campaign. Is there a Trump or Clinton factor at play in this race?
Well, one key point that I didn't mention earlier is that this race was, in 2012, one of the closest congressional districts, probably anywhere in the country. It was decided by 226 votes in favor of Barack Obama in a race where 400,000 votes were cast. So the Democrats see that's an opportunity. If they can kind of hitch to Hillary Clinton, if she performs anywhere near what Barack Obama did, there might be down ballot coattails.
All right. We'll be keeping an eye on it tomorrow night. That's Brian Bax. Stick around, Brian.
Absolutely. Another very expensive congressional race here in Minnesota, certainly hotly contested. The congressional race in Minnesota's 8th District, which covers the northwestern or northeastern quarter of the state, all the way from Canadian border to the edge of the Twin City metropolitan area. That contest is a rematch from 2 years ago with Democratic incumbent Rick Nolan running against Republican Stuart Mills.
And Mark Zedeklik has been covering that for us. In fact, Mark is up in the district right now. Mark, where are you?
Good afternoon. I'm in Eveleth, Mike.
Eveleth. What's happening today? What are the candidates doing up there?
Actually, I'm in Virginia. Well, they're campaigning. Stuart Mills was with Mike Pence in Duluth for that rally this morning. Rick Nolan was up in the Iron Range areas where I am right now yesterday and also this morning. Mills is on his way now up to the range. He may even be here by now campaigning. And Congressman Nolan is in Duluth.
Nolan won a close race in this district against Stuart Mills 2 years ago. Why does Mills think he can beat him this time?
Well, it was very close. He came within 1.5% percentage points of getting Nolan's seat. He thinks Nolan's out of touch with the district. He thinks that voters around the 8th district are looking for new faces in Washington. He thinks Nolan's vulnerable on national security issues and has really been playing that heavy in this race. He's criticized Congressman Nolan for supporting the Iran nuclear deal and also for initially calling to bring large numbers of Syrian refugees to the United States. Nolan later ended up supporting a measure that would have made that more difficult. But National security is a big area that Stuart Mills is focused on as he goes after Congressman Nolan.
And what's Rick Nolan saying? What's his case for reelection?
He says he's been effective in Washington and talks about successful efforts to reduce Chinese steel dumping by increasing tariffs and policing that more closely. He talks about standing up to protect programs like Medicare and Social Security. He talks about being a friend of mining, including controversial new precious metal mining, which he says should go forward if it can be done without harming the environment. And he also talks about kind of bread and butter stuff, just bringing a lot of federal money for infrastructure projects to the 8th District.
And Mark, is there a Trump factor in this race?
There absolutely is. This is a unique district where it's common thinking that Trump will actually help the candidate up here who's Republican so that Stuart Mills will benefit from Trump being on the ballot. Mills has happily accepted Trump as a nominee and kind of sees himself not in his style per se, but his life history and that kind of thing is similar to Trump in that he's a political outsider with a business background. So Mills is hoping Trump will pull him past the finish line tomorrow.
All right, Mark Zadeklik from the Iron Range. Thanks, Mark. Keep an eye on it. We'll talk to you tomorrow night.
There is a third competitive congressional race here in Minnesota. This is in the 3rd District, which covers the western and northwestern suburbs. Republican Eric Paulson is being challenged by DFL State Senator Terry Bonnoff.
And Brian Baxt is back to talk about that. Brian, we've been talking about this Trump factor. It seems like Trump is the issue in this race.
That's right. This is one of those districts where Hillary Clinton has opened up quite a wide lead over Donald Trump with suburban voters, suburban women voters in particular. And so the Democrats have tried really hard to say that Eric Paulson was either supporting him or a clone of him. And it's caused him some problem in how to talk about it. As of late, he's talked about how he's not supporting Donald Trump. He's disavowed him. He said he's going to write in a candidate, Marco Rubio, who won his district and won the state in the March caucuses. But the ads have been intense as Eric Paulson equals Donald Trump.
And Eric Paulson even had a rally with Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, last week, and they never mentioned Donald Trump.
Didn't come up. I mean, this is kind of the part of the district is more kind of the traditional Republican. The moderate Republicans do quite well there. So it made sense to bring someone like Paul Ryan, who speaks to that wing of the party, in.
And it's interesting that both Eric Paulson and Terry Bonnoff are sort of pro-business type people within their parties. What does that tell us about the 3rd District?
I don't think Democrats would have much of a chance to even come close there if they had a traditional kind of left-wing candidate out there. There's a lot of corporate headquarters out there. There's a lot of wealth out there. So I think a lot of the issues that they talk about are about making business easier. You know, they both agree about the medical device tax. But Terry Bonnoff has been hit quite a bit on her votes over taxes and her comments on taxes. And so that's been the way that Eric Paulson has tried to proceed in this campaign. And he's also brought up the healthcare issue quite a bit.
And lots of commercials in this one, too. How much outside money is coming into this race?
That one is nearing $7 million in outside money at latest check. And as we talked about in the 2nd District, that has kind of been an equalizer because Eric Paulson is a prolific fundraiser. He sits on the Ways and Means Committee, so he's able to bring in money quite easily. He's spent about $4 million in the race, and Terry Bonnoff spent about $1.4 million.
I think the last time I looked, the 8th is drawing the most outside money. I think it's maybe twice what's
coming. Yeah, that's at $17 million and climbing. It's one of the most expensive in the country.
And just one last question now. If Eric Paulson wins tomorrow, might he run for governor in 2018? There's an open seat for governor.
He's been mentioned quite a bit as a statewide candidate. When I did have a chance to sit down with him a few weeks ago, I asked him. He said he's ruling nothing out. But the one thing that could come back to haunt him is the Trump thing. You know, there are a lot of passionate Trump supporters out there around the state, and they say that they're going to have long memories. I talked to a couple at the rally yesterday, and they said they're taking names of folks who weren't with Trump.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. So, Gary, that's 3 congressional districts we'll have an eye on tomorrow.
Maureen Shaver, Todd Rapp, all of these congressional races have been swamped. People in the districts have been swamped with advertising, most of it pretty nasty. Does that really help voters make up their mind? Maureen.
You know, I think it does. It has to. It's the only thing that we have. I would ask Professor Pearson about that. Is what is effective? These we certainly have three great races in Minnesota this time to determine afterwards what worked. But these are many negative ads. I think what we'll find, too, is the candidates that fit their districts are usually the ones who win.
Todd?
The commercials are important because these three races are so important. They really are a national barometer. If Republicans swept all three, there probably won't be very much movement in control of Congress. If Democrats sweep all three, there's a very good chance that Democrats reach 218, 219, 220 to take a very narrow control of the U.S. House. So that's why we're seeing this. And in a lot of cases, they're just throwing whatever they can at the wall to see if something will influence 1,000 or 3,000 voters who have yet to make a decision in this race.
So what are you hearing? I mean, what are the prospects in these three races, Todd?
Second district is really a microcosm of the presidential race. I think Brian's got that right. Third district is the ultimate split-ticket suburban district in the country. It's really about whether Eric Paulson has separated himself from Donald Trump. The 8th district is about the quickly changing landscape in rural America and how it's moved away from the farmer Democratic control into a more Republican control. Three incredibly different races. And as I say, those three together are going to tell us a lot about what happens nationally.
Maureen?
The 2nd district is ironic. The Democrat is a very well-off person running using a lot of her own money and I think has a fairly good chance of winning. But then if Hillary Clinton is our next president, she's going to have a very hard time winning a re-election in a midterm. Jason Lewis, probably a little further to the right, a long history. Even though he's not he hasn't been in office before, he has a lot that was able to be thrown at him because of his 25 years in radio. So I think that's tough, and it's going to have a big impact on some of those legislative races. In the 3rd, Eric Paulson fits that district to a T. Just like Bill Frenzel, just like Jim Ramstead, he fits that district. He will be reelected. Terry Bonoff got in that race very, very late. She is the classic kind of candidate that could have done well, but I just think got in the race too late. And the 8th is too close to call. I think those are the classic Trump. If Stuart Mills wins, it's because he is reflecting what is going on in those in that district. And I think it's also going to have a big impact in the legislative races. Again, back to that, those people feel left behind in terms of the recovery from 2008.
Maureen Shaver, Todd Rapp. Now, besides electing or reelecting all 8 members of the Minnesota delegation to the U.S. House, we're also electing all 201 members of the Minnesota legislature. And right now, the DFL controls the Minnesota Senate. Republicans control the Minnesota House. Tim Pugmire joins us. Tim, what are you hearing about these legislative races?
Well, a lot of competition statewide, but it always boils down to a very small subset of truly competitive districts. In this case, I would say somewhere in the range of 24 or more are worth watching. We have competitive open seats in the House and Senate. There are seats that Republicans won from the DFL in 2014. And there are some rural and suburban House and Senate seats where the incumbents of the district, the incumbents are in districts that are trending either redder or bluer than they are. For instance, DFLers in districts that Mitt Romney won in 2012 and Republicans in districts that President Obama won in 2012.
And Tim, the Democrats need to flip control of 6 seats in the 134-member House to take control. In the Senate, the Republicans have to flip a total of 7 to take over. And you say, really, there are only a handful of seats really competitive in each House, right?
Yeah, that's right. And a point of clarification, actually only 133 of the 134 House seats are going to be decided tomorrow. That's because House District 32B is going to have to wait for a special election in February. You may remember the Minnesota Supreme Court back in September ruled that incumbent Republican Representative Bob Barrett did not live in the district and was declared ineligible. So,
and some of these key seats are rematches, right? Some really close where a candidate lost 2 years ago and maybe has a chance to pick it up again this time. Just give us a quick rundown of some of those seats.
That's right. There are 5 House rematches where defeated Democrats are trying to win back the seats they lost in 2014. One getting a lot of attention and a lot of outside spending is in St. Cloud, Republican Jim Knobloch facing a challenge again from DFLer Zach Dorholt, who lost 2 years ago by just 69 votes. The others, three in West Central Minnesota, Tim Miller against Andrew Falk, Dave Baker against Mary Swatsky, and then in the Faribault area, Brian Daniels, the incumbent Republican, facing a challenge again from DFLer Patty Fritz.
And are there any common issues in these key districts statewide that you can point to and say this could make a difference?
Well, health care has really heated things up the past few weeks after the announcement of those big premium increases that are coming for the individual market coverage. It's a topic that Republicans have been criticizing Democrats on for a long time. They've been out campaigning on the need for political balance at the Capitol and pointing to the recent 2 years of all DFL control as a time of unchecked spending and policymaking. And one of the examples that they've been using is the creation of MnSure and the full embrace of the Affordable Care Act during that time frame.
All right, Tim. Well, you keep an eye on it. Might be a late night for you tomorrow night.
It sure will. It will be interesting to find out the margins or the majority control, also the margins and how slim or wide they might be.
Right. And, Gary, this will have a big influence on Governor Mark Dayton, who has 2 years left in his term, and see if there's still divided government at the Capitol or if he has the DFL party behind him in both houses.
Indeed, it'll be interesting to watch. There's only one statewide race on the ballot that we can watch, a fairly low-profile contest for the state Supreme Court. Incumbent Associate Justice Natalie Hudson is being challenged by attorney Michelle McDonald. However, there is also a proposed change to the state constitution on the ballot. That amendment would change who decides how much legislators should get paid. Now, right now, legislators themselves make that decision. They have to vote to raise their pay. Under this amendment, a bipartisan citizens' council would make that decision. And Maureen, Todd, you might think that a hot topic like legislative pay would generate lots of debate, but we haven't heard much about this at all. Why? Maureen.
Well, I think usually we hear more about it when people organize campaigns around this, and no one has organized a campaign. Nobody's funding an effort. Nobody's having debates about it. And I think that's why it's had much less for us to hear about, especially when we've had a lot of personalities at the top of the ticket.
Todd?
It's not really asking a very compelling public question. It's not about transportation or healthcare or education. It's about how we determine legislative pay. And I think the big issue is going to be whether or not the drop-off, that is the people who don't vote on the amendment, whether that is so large that it makes it almost impossible for the yes side to get enough votes to pass this.
Explain how that works.
Sure. In a constitutional amendment, you've got to get a simple majority, but you add the no votes to the people who don't vote on the amendment. That is, they show up and vote on another race, but then they don't cast a vote on the amendment. So you add the no and the non-voters together. In 1980, we had five constitutional amendments on the ballot. They all had more yes votes than no votes. Four of them did not pass because of the drop-off. Only one made it. And that's the risk. It's not been a risk with some of the recent constitutional amendments, but I wouldn't be surprised to see 12, 15, even 20% drop-off this year.
Maureen, do you have any idea? I mean, do constitutional amendments, proposed amendments, usually pass? Do they usually fail? What generally happens?
Well, I probably should give this over to my colleague, Todd, because he's run these campaigns. But when they get a lot of attention and a lot of money spent on them, they usually pass. But, Todd, you're better prepared to answer this question.
Well, we've been pretty successful in passing them in the state, but remember, a lot of the early ones were related to the use of the railroads and some of the big banking issues. In recent years, there was a pretty good success record until 2012, when both voter ID and the marriage amendment failed.
Todd Rapp, who is a Democrat, Maureen Shaver, our Republican analyst, and back again, U of M political scientist Catherine Pearson. A couple of questions, more questions for you. Number one, I want to ask about polling.
Yes.
Now, we were told at one point, boy, the polls, don't trust them because they're not accurate. Are the polls that we're currently hearing about can we assume they're accurate?
The best way to interpret polls is to look at polling averages, because from reputable polls, because pollsters do their best to get a representative sample, and when they don't, weight accordingly so that they can generalize to the population they're trying to. You know, their reputation is at stake. But it is harder to reach people these days. A lot of the polls do use cell phones now, but it's harder to reach people. And so there can be some outlier polls, but the polling averages of reputable polls do give us a pretty good snapshot in time. You just don't want to make too many predictions based on polls because things can change.
Are you concerned about what's going to happen after tomorrow? Or do you think everything will fall into place as it traditionally has fallen into place?
Well, I'm certainly hopeful that everything will fall into place. That's been our history of peaceful transitions, and so that is what I'm expecting. But this has been a very vitriolic campaign, and so with Donald Trump suggesting that he may or may not sort of accept the legitimacy of the outcome, sure, there's a little bit of concern. But in general, I trust that our history of peaceful transitions will continue.
Curious, Catherine, what are your students saying about this election? What, for many of them, this is the first one they've been through.
Right. I teach 150 undergrads at the University of Minnesota in a campaigns and elections course. So this is a group of students who are obviously very interested in the election, and they are following it very closely. They're deeply engaged. But they are feeling the negativity. Many of them volunteer, and many of them are enthusiastic either about a presidential candidate or a legislative candidate. But I do see more pessimism, more concern about the negativity, and actually fewer volunteers than in many years. I think back to 2008 when I taught this class, or even 2012, there was a lot of student activity around the ballot initiatives. And this election does seem somewhat different. Again, despite the deep engagement, more pessimism. Again, whether or not it's because their candidate didn't win their party's nomination, or they support a third party candidate, or they're really enthusiastic about their candidate, but they just don't like the negativity.
Are you having fun this year?
It is always interesting to analyze American politics. So, yes, I am having fun. Thank you.
Lots to analyze.
Yes.
University of Minnesota political scientist Catherine Pearson joining us here on our special NPR News Presents Election Eve special. Mike, big program tomorrow night.
Absolutely. We'll have reporters out across the state watching what happens, counting the votes. We'll start at 7 o'clock on the radio. We'll be online. And, of course, the Minnesota results will start coming in after 8 once the polls are closed.
Polls will open at 7 tomorrow morning, and they will remain open until 8 o'clock tomorrow night. Now, if you are in line at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, don't panic. As long as you're in line, you get to vote. And so just hang in there. Now, where to vote? Well, you can find out where to vote at the Secretary of State's website, and we have a link at nprnews.org. A link to the Secretary of State's office, or check with your local city or county office, and they can tell you where to go. You have to be 18 years old, and you must have lived in Minnesota for the past 20 days to be eligible to vote. If you aren't registered, you can register tomorrow at the polls. You need to prove your identity and where you live. And in fact, most areas you can vote absentee yet today. Early voting until 5 o'clock. Well, that's it for our Election Eve special. Thanks for joining us. Again, our election coverage tomorrow night starts at 7, so do tune in. With political editor Mike Mulcahy and our analysts, Catherine Pearson, Maureen Shaver, and Todd Rapp, I'm Gary Eichten. Good afternoon.